From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Walmart, how it transformed retailing for better and for worse. We talk with Bob Ortega of the Wall Street Journal, author of a new book about Walmart. Also, we hear from Harvard's John Stilgo, who teaches his students how to see new things in the everyday world. He shows them what they can learn by observing telephone poles, abandoned railroad tracks, and walls painted green. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews War Orphans, the new release by Swedish pianist Bobo Stenson, who has influenced the sound associated with the ECM label. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. On Capitol Hill, independent counsel Kenneth Starr says President Clinton's deliberate lies under oath and concerted efforts to obstruct justice are at the heart of his impeachment referral. Starr is testifying before a fractious House Judiciary Committee. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Starr says his office makes no judgment about the president's relationship with Monica Lewinsky. Rather, he says the impeachment referral focuses on what Starr calls the president's efforts to obstruct justice, including a list of lies under oath in the Paula Jones case.
The president testified that he did not know that Vernon Jordan had met with Ms. Lewinsky and talked about the Jones case. That was untrue. He testified that he could not recall being alone with Ms. Lewinsky. That was untrue.
Earlier, Starr sat stone-faced through a blistering attack by ranking Democrat John Conyers, who called Starr a federally paid sex policeman.
The sense of desperation in the face of a failed impeachment inquiry is palpable.
Later, Starr will undergo questioning by committee members. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, The Capitol.
The Israeli cabinet has approved the first stage of a troop pullback from the West Bank. It's part of the Middle East Peace Accord signed at the White House on October 23rd. The cabinet gave its go-ahead after ministers agreed that the Palestinians had met their demands to crack down on Islamic militants. A senior Israeli government official says the troop withdrawals will begin tomorrow. UN inspectors are back on the job today in Iraq. It's the second consecutive day that UN's arms monitors have been allowed to check out suspected weapons sites. One of the two men accused of the murder of a gay University of Wyoming student will make a preliminary court appearance today in Laramie, Wyoming. Bob Beck of Wyoming Public Radio reports.
For the first time, prosecutors will lay out their case against 21-year-old Aaron McKinney, one of two men accused of taking Matthew Shepard from a downtown Laramie bar to the outskirts of town, where authorities say they tied him to a fence, robbed him, beat him several times with a gun, and left him for dead. Prosecutors need to prove that it was likely that McKinney was involved in the murder. The other man accused of the crime, Russell Henderson, and two women who have been charged with accessory after the fact have already waived their preliminary hearings. If McKinney is bound over to district court, he will await arraignment and an eventual decision by prosecutor Cal Verrucca, who is considering the death penalty. For NPR News, I'm Bob Beck in Laramie, Wyoming.
Teachers are on strike in New Jersey's second largest school system. The union representing 2,500 teachers and 1,000 teachers' aides and support staff called the strike early this morning after contract talks failed. Administrators and substitute teachers are filling in. At last check on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up a fraction at 9,041.37. That's an active trading of 304 million shares. The Nasdaq was up about 18. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, stocks have fallen off somewhat on Wall Street after moving higher following the opening bell. The Dow Jones Industrials remain above the 9,000 mark. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
Amid what has generally been a fairly positive climate for stocks this week, the market has given back some of its earlier gains today. One reason is a regional manufacturing survey that showed an unexpected softening last month in the manufacturing sector. Philadelphia Fed reported today its manufacturing index last month dipped 8 points, a sign the economy may be losing a little steam. That was not the case on the housing front, though, where construction of new homes and apartments soared by a stunning 7.3% in October. The near-record pace of building followed 2 down months, in part due to hurricanes and storms that hit the southern U.S. Meanwhile, two large senior health care companies announced today that they will merge. American Retirement Corp. says it's agreed to acquire Assisted Living Concepts in a deal valued at roughly $500 million. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
American Airlines has announced it's agreed to buy Reno Air for $124 million in cash. It's a move designed to give American a stronger foothold on the West Coast. Under terms of the deal, American is paying $7.75 a share for the low-fare carrier. The Reno purchase should be completed by early 1999. Retailer Venator Group is reporting a bigger-than-expected quarterly loss. Venator says weak sales of athletic apparel and warm-weather clothing during the back-to-school shopping season hurt its bottom line. BMW says it's suspending tours of its assembly line at its plant in South Carolina. That's to conceal preparations for its new sport utility vehicle, the X5. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, offering a world to explore through books and music. Location information, 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Walmart is not just a big discount store. It's one of the world's largest corporations of any kind and is still growing. The discount empire includes over 1,850 Walmart stores, 543 supercenters, and 450 Sam's Clubs in the U.S. It has nearly 800,000 employees in the U.S. Walmart's retailing approach has been copied by other retail chains and by other fields of American business. And that's good news or bad news, depending on your point of view. Walmart is famous for its low prices, for conquering its competition, and for keeping out unions. My guest Bob Ortega has written a new book about Walmart and its founder Sam Walton called In Sam We Trust. Ortega covered retailing for the Wall Street Journal and now writes about the American West for the paper. Ortega says that Sam Walton transformed retailing the way Henry Ford revolutionized transportation.
What I mean by that is that Henry Ford didn't invent the car. He didn't invent the assembly line. What he did was to make them the new paradigms, to make life without cars or life without assembly lines unimaginable. And in the same way, Sam Walton has completely changed the way that retailing operates, partly by developing very aggressively technologies that are now used by all retailers, and partly by changing the way that people operate, and in ways that reach far beyond retailing. He, for example, was very aggressive about adopting the use of part-time and temporary labor, which is now the norm in our new service economy. Also, he was very aggressive about moving into small towns. He took mass merchandising practices into many communities that had never seen them before.
Before Sam Walton started Walmart, he bought a franchise store. It was a Ben Franklin store, which I guess is a five and dime. How did he get into that?
Well, he was very interested. Actually, he was very interested originally in buying a department store in St. Louis, but his wife, Helen Walton, vetoed that idea because she did not want to live in a big city. She wanted to live in a small town. That forced him to look at buying a Ben Franklin franchise, which was a five and dime store. And the way that he was able to buy that was basically with his wife's money. She came from a very wealthy family, and her father basically bankrolled Sam Walton to his first store to the tune of about $25,000, which today would be about, say, roughly $225,000, the equivalent value.
What was the advantage for someone in Sam Walton's position at the time to start in business by buying a franchise?
Well, the advantage of buying into a franchise as opposed to doing it on your own was that you could learn from the experience of the company. That is to say, if you were a small store owner operating on your own, you had to know how to do everything, accounting, how to buy goods, everything from sweeping the floors to merchandising and advertising and selling and buying everything. On the other hand, if you were part of a franchise, you would be given help with accounting. You would be given help with sales. You would be told how much to buy of different items and how to merchandise them, how to sell them. Everything was laid out for you so that you didn't have to have a great deal of experience to be able to operate in a pretty good fashion.
Now, how did he parlay his Ben Franklin stores into Walmart?
Once he was in Bentonville, and his first store there was successful, he opened a second store and then a third and then a fourth, and he eventually became the largest Ben Franklin franchisor in the country. But he also became aware by the late 1950s that he faced a tremendous threat from these discount stores that were starting to spring up all over the place. So he made a point of going east, visiting a lot of these discount store operations. seeing what they were doing, and then deciding that was what he needed to do. Now, the big difference between what Walton was doing and the other early discounters was that because he had operated five and dime stores in these very small communities, he knew that there was more business in these small towns than most other folks suspected. So he started out by opening these Walmart stores in very, very small towns that other discounters were ignoring. The advantage of doing that was that, of course, he faced less competition. He didn't have to compete with the big guys because they were ignoring these small towns. He only had to face competition from these little merchants.
Well, how did he find enough business in small towns to keep open large discount stores?
Well, of course, the discount stores didn't start out anywhere near the size that they are today. They were much smaller, but they were just big compared to the other stores in that community. But the reality in many of these towns was that folks were getting in their cars and driving into the big cities every once in a while to buy a lot of stuff at a cheaper price. Walton knew that if he could offer them those same goods that they were driving into the city to get, they'd stay in town and buy it at his place.
How did he keep prices down?
The first thing that he did was to start scouting out other places to buy goods that were cheaper. Most franchisers in those days sold the goods to the franchisee stores themselves and then took a certain markup on everything. But by going out and finding independent middlemen who would get stuff for him on the cheap, he could get things for a much, much lower markup, say 5%. And he didn't really care too much in the early days about the quality of the goods. He just wanted to get the lowest price that he could. So he'd hop in his truck and drive to Missouri or drive to Oklahoma or drive to wherever the heck he needed to go to be able to get really cheap stuff. And he'd just buy big truckloads of it and then haul it back.
I think another way Walton kept prices down was to keep out union labor. What was his approach to keeping unions out of his stores?
Well, in the early days, his approach was pretty simple. He threatened to fire anybody who unionized.
Uh-huh.
At the same time, what he did once he realized that he faced a threat from the unions was to hire people who could help him keep the unions out. In the first couple of stores, they just essentially told the employees, look, if you vote for the union, we're going to fire everybody and close the doors. But this fellow that he hired as one of his early union busters, a guy by the name of John Tate, who later became an executive at the company, told Walton very early on, look, we can keep these workers from unionizing by kind of crushing them every time they try to do this, or you can make them think that you're on their side. You can take steps to make the workers feel more faith in you and the company. And Walton saw that this was an approach that would work. So he was one of the first retailers to institute profit sharing, for example, which allowed the regular worker, not just executives, but the regular worker, to invest in the company's stock and to share from the growth in the company's profits. And that was a huge step. It was done in response to unionizing efforts, but it also made an enormous difference. Many of those early employees in Walmart, even after working 20 years for $5 and $6 an hour, were able to retire with hundreds of thousands of dollars.
I think the tactics got more hardball both on Walmart's part and on the part of unions who wanted to unionize Walmart workers as years went by.
Oh, sure, absolutely. It's interesting that on the Walmart side, Walton himself had no compunctions whatsoever about violating National Labor Relations Act laws in terms of anything that it took to keep the unions out. And at the same time, the unions, seeing Walton and Walmart as more of a threat as they moved into the Northeast and into California and into heavily unionized parts of the country, became very aggressive as well. They were worried that by offering competition to unionized grocery stores and unionized shops, that Walton would force those shops to seek concessions from their workers so they could compete. So they responded by taking a very long-term view. They knew that it would be very difficult to organize the Walmart stores because Walton would feel no compunction about firing workers who tried to organize or about even shutting down a store if necessary. So they adopted the approach of saying, well, what let's do is instead, let's try to attack the way that workers perceive the company. One of the things that certain unions like the United Food and Commercial Workers and FAST, which is part of the AFL-CIO, it's the Food and Allied Service Trades, one of the things that they did was to do research on Walmart, to dig up as much dirt as they could about the company. Back in 1992, when Dateline NBC did their first expose of Walmart's sale of goods made by child labor in Bangladesh, all of that information came from the unions who actually dug it up in the first place. It was all perfectly true, but it was provided to the reporters by the union.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bob Ortega. He's a reporter for the Wall Street Journal and is the author of a new book about the history of Walmart. It's called In Sam We Trust. Early on, I think, you know, when a Walmart opened in a small town, probably a lot of the people were pretty glad to see that they could have discount goods without having to drive many miles into a city. But I think in recent years, a lot of Walmarts have met with a lot of resistance as they've moved into the Northeast and moved into more urban areas. People are often afraid that it's going to hurt the downtown area, that a lot of smaller stores will be put out of business. Unions often get angry if a Walmart moves into town or near town. Would you talk about that change in attitude toward Walmarts?
Well, sure. I think that part of the reason for that is that in the early days, people didn't know what a Walmart was like. They didn't know what it would be like when it came into town. But over the years, as we started to see stories about small town downtowns drying up, people began to see that when these giant retailers come into town, things change. Now, of course, it's as true of other retailers, the Kmarts, for example, as it is of Walmart. But Walmart became the poster child for sprawl because they're the biggest, they're the most aggressive, and they have a pattern of going into smaller communities. So gradually over the years, we've seen, I mean, there was resistance in towns as long ago as 15, 16 years ago, but we've seen it growing and growing and growing. A second reason that we've seen it growing quite a bit in recent years is that in the early days, if there was a group in some town that was fighting, say, to keep a Walmart out, they were essentially operating on their own. Nowadays, we have whole groups that communicate with each other, that maintain internet sites, that provide information to other towns where there are fights going on so that they have the benefit of the experience of all these other fights that have gone on before, which makes it easier to fight.
How do the fears that some communities have about what will happen if a Walmart opens near them compare to the reality of the impact of Walmart on local business and local downtowns?
Well, it's pretty clear that there really is a dramatic impact, particularly in small towns, but even in suburbs. There have been extensive studies that have been done, and there's really no question about it. Walmart will argue that merchants can compete by changing what they sell, for example, or opening longer hours. But the reality is, if you're Joe's Hardware Store and you're selling a wrench for more money, I mean, you're buying wrenches from your supplier for a higher price than Walmart is putting it out at retail, there's no way you can compete. That's just the reality of the situation. So for a lot of these merchants, they're in big trouble once a Walmart comes into town.
So what's the difference between the technique, say, that Walmart used to establish itself when its competition was basically small businesses compared to in the later years when its competition was, Kmart and other big discounters and other big hypermarts, as they're called?
Well, the difference was one of size. In the early days, because Walmart was very small, Walton had to pick out small towns where the competition wasn't too tough. Now, by the time that he snuck up on the big companies like Kmart and Sears, because they'd never paid attention to him, he was in these little towns that nobody knew about or nobody looked at, and suddenly he was this huge company, and he was competing with Kmart and Sears, but he had developed this incredibly efficient operation. He could buy goods using his size. He had the clout to buy goods for very little money. But more importantly, because obviously Sears and Kmart were large too, he had a more efficient operation. He could get the goods delivered and sell them and get them off the shelves far more cheaply than Kmart or Sears because he had developed this incredibly sophisticated distribution system. This was one of the keys to Walmart's success. Walton was always looking for better technology and for people who knew how to do things better than he did so that he was one of the very first folks to be very aggressive about adopting computers. He was very early to adopt satellite communications technology. And today, for example, when you walk into a Walmart store and you buy something, that information is instantly transmitted not only back to headquarters but to the supplier from whom Walmart bought the goods and to the factory that makes the goods. And Walmart can track that every step of the way so that they've always got the stuff arriving in the stores just when they need it. And other retailers, even today, haven't really caught up. I mean, they all have the same computers and the same satellite communications technology, but they don't use it quite as efficiently. That's the big advantage.
Kmart was, and I guess still is, one of Walmart's big competitors. But Walmart seemed to have come up from behind and licked Kmart, at least for a while. How did it do that?
Well, Interestingly enough, it was as much Kmart's failures as Walmart's successes that were responsible for that. If you go back to the early 1970s and look at reports that analysts from Wall Street were writing at the time, they were all predicting that Kmart was going to be the dominant retailer of the latter part of the 20th century because it was expected to just crush Sears and be number one for a long time to come. And then Walmart came up out of nowhere. Two reasons for that. One, of course, was that Walton always was looking for a better way to do things. He was always looking for a way to improve the store and to become more efficient, and he always figured that there must be improvements that could be made. And at Kmart, unfortunately, the company became very, very complacent. A lot of the executives thought that they had got their formula down and they didn't need to think about ever making changes or improving. So, for example, in the early 70s, Kmart had gone to selling a lot of polyester clothing. And when fashions changed, they didn't. And they were identified as the polyester palace. And people just stopped buying clothes there, for example. And there were a lot of other areas in which the company just stopped adapting to change. And they essentially nearly self-destructed as a result.
So how does Walmart and Kmart compare with each other now?
Well, Walmart is now about four times larger than Kmart. In fact, if you were to go back to, say, 10 years ago, Kmart probably had about 30% of the discount retail market, and Walmart had about 5 or 6%, and now Walmart has about 40%, 45%, and Kmart has maybe 12%. Hmm. So, I mean, their positions have completely reversed.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bob Ortega. He covers the West for The Wall Street Journal, used to cover retailing. His new book is called In Sam We Trust, and it's a history of Walmart. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bob Ortega, and he's written A New History of Walmart, and it's also about the impact of Walmart on retailing in America, and the book is called In Sam We Trust, Sam as in Sam Walton, the founder of Walmart. Now, if I remember correctly from your book, Walmart is the largest retailer of toothpaste, soap. What are the other items?
Well, name it. They are the biggest seller of children's clothes, of underwear, CDs. They are one of the biggest retailer of books. Toiletries they're the biggest seller of. There's dozens and dozens of items. I mean, we are talking about a company here that is not only the largest retailer in the world, but larger than numbers 2, 3, and 4 put together.
Okay, that's a lot of power in determining what items are showcased best in the stores, what items are carried at all in stores. How has Walmart used that power?
One of the big impacts that Walmart has had through the use of its power is that by driving its vendors, its suppliers, to give it goods for the lowest possible price, they have actually pushed many American manufacturers to move their factories overseas. They have been one of the leaders in that area. And the result has been that, in fact, we've seen a lot of manufacturing shift out of the U.S. over the last 15, 20 years.
In order to keep prices down for the big discount stores.
In order to keep prices down, yeah. It's a lot cheaper to hire a 12-year-old in Guatemala for 19 cents an hour, obviously, than a union member in South Carolina for, say, $9.50 an hour.
For a while, the big PR campaign for Walmart stores was buy American. You know, they had American-made goods, and so buy American, buy there. But this coincided with the period when a lot of the manufacturers were going to developing countries because of the cheap labor there. So how truthful was that buy American campaign?
Not particularly. I mean, Walton was very smart in that in the late 70s and early 80s because the manufacturing had already started to move overseas. In fact, Walmart had, as I said, been an engine of that. But there was a backlash building. Unions in particular were very concerned, and that was why Walton, in fact, began the Buy American campaign. The Buy American campaign was really from the start more about marketing than anything else, and I spoke to people who were involved in it right at the beginning, and that's very clear. Walton saw this as a way both to position the company favorably in the eyes of consumers, and as a way to pressure his makers, his manufacturers, both in the U.S. and overseas, to lower their prices. The reality is that over the 10 years since Walmart put that program into place, the percentage of imported goods they sell has gone up, not down.
What impact did it have on Walmart when the Kathy Lee Gifford clothing line that she did was revealed to be based on the labor in, I forget which country it was, but I think there were like kids working.
Honduras.
Yeah, right, and they were employing like children for very low wages. Did that have any impact on Walmart?
Well, Walmart likes to argue that it didn't, but I think that there is some evidence that it did. I mean, the reality is that in the case of Kathy Lee, it was very embarrassing because she advertised that she gave a percentage of her profits to children's charities. So the idea, obviously, of children working in sweatshops to make clothes to benefit children is a little bit ironic, to say the least. But the other thing, of course, here is that for the people who were targeting groups like the National Labor Committee, which is an organization that targets child labor in sweatshops, for them, Kathy Lee made the perfect target. Because it's one thing to say, oh, a faceless corporation, say Walmart, is selling goods made by children. It's another thing to target a celebrity. For someone like Kathy Lee Gifford, her celebrity is what she has to sell. And so for her, it was imperative to address these issues once they were raised. And in fact, Kathy Lee wound up going and meeting with Robert Reich, who was then the Secretary of Labor, and getting involved in this anti-sweatshop issue. Now, to give the woman credit, other celebrities, when these issues were raised, have done far less. I mean, Michael Jordan, for example, when folks were raising questions about the conditions under which Nikes were made, essentially said, look, it's not my problem. Go talk to Nike. Of course, he has another talent to offer playing basketball. In the case of Kathy Lee, she really had to address this. But to give her credit, she did take some steps. Now, I think, unfortunately, she was a bit hypocritical about this. I happened to be in Bentonville at Walmart's annual meeting on June 7th, 2 years ago, and this was the day after she had appeared in Washington talking about how she was really committed to addressing the sweatshop issue. She then went and spoke in front of essentially what you could call the home crowd at the Walmart annual meeting and turned 180 degrees, saying that, you know, people were only after her because she was successful and that she knew that she hadn't done anything wrong and Walmart hadn't done anything wrong, and going off on a really kind of bizarre rampage, saying, you know, in this country, people will forgive you for murder and they'll forgive you for rape, but they won't forgive you for being a success. And, you know, to the cheers of the Walmart crowd, it was really a bit surprising, given what she'd been saying only 24 hours earlier.
Bob Ortega is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. His new book about Walmart is called In Sam We Trust. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our talk about Walmart with Bob Ortega. Harvard's John Stilgo helps us observe ordinary things in the everyday world. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new release by Swedish pianist Bobo Stenson, who influenced the ECM sound. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Bob Ortega of The Wall Street Journal. He's written a new book about Walmart and its founder, Sam Walton, called In Sam We Trust. This gets back to what we were talking about earlier, the amount of power Walmart has by virtue of how much it sells and how much it buys from suppliers. Walmart sells a lot of CDs and a lot of books. I believe there have been times when it has refused to sell certain records or books because of controversial language or subject matter.
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely the case. And, of course, as a retailer, it's perfectly within their power to say what they do and don't want to carry. What's interesting about this, I think, is that a lot of record companies in particular have actually sanitized lyrics and censored their own albums in order to be carried in Walmart stores. So what you find is that a lot of these companies will actually, without Walmart even asking them to, a lot of these companies will go and trim lyrics or rewrite and essentially create a Walmartized version of a CD so that they'll be sold at the Walmart stores.
No, why does Walmart have that attitude? Is it because of their concerns for customers? Is there just a kind of conservative streak within the company itself?
No, it's both. I think there is a conservative streak within the company, and the guys that are at the top are small-town Arkansas guys, basically, and they're pretty conservative in their outlook. And Walmart positions itself as a family-friendly kind of place. They like to say that they promote family values. And as a result, that means that they're very cautious about certain types of goods that they carry.
What kind of books have not made it into Walmart?
Well, mine, for one. As far as other books, well, most books don't make it into a Walmart, and the reason for that is purely commercial. The company is predicated on the idea of really high turnover. So they're only, for example, going to offer the New York Times bestsellers or the books that are going to be bestsellers in a certain region. They're not going to carry a big selection of books because they want to have stuff that's going to shoot out the doors as quickly as possible.
Right.
So this is a problem for bookstores because in one sense, you could argue that Walmart is cannibalizing their sales because they're taking all of the top sellers but not carrying this other inventory that all the other bookstores have to carry. That's just part of the nature of competition these days.
What directions in retail do you think that Walmart helped to lead the way on, directions that retail is still heading in?
Well, one of them is the use of ever larger stores. One of them is also the appearance of what we call category killers. If you go out to the typical, say, shopping mall these days, you'll see like an Office Max office supply store or a Toys R Us toy store or, giant stores that specialize in certain kinds of items, including giant bookstores like Barnes & Noble and Borders, which are among that category. And all of these so-called category killers really owe their origins to the same philosophy that created Walmart. They are all imitators of Sam Walton. And in fact, actually, the way of thinking that Walton exemplifies goes well beyond retailing. To give you a good example, Columbia HCA, which is the largest operator of hospitals in the country, Richard Scott, who's the head honcho there, says that Walton and Walmart are his model for how he wants to operate. Now, Columbia HCA has become a target for criticism in recent years for what folks refer to as drive-by operations. That is the idea that, you know, you push people out of the hospital as quickly as possible so that you can get your revenues up and get your costs down. And this is one of the unfortunate impacts of this way of thinking.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bob Ortega, and he covers the West for The Wall Street Journal, used to cover retailing for The Wall Street Journal. Did you find yourself shopping in Walmart a lot while you were writing your Walmart book?
I found myself in a lot of Walmart stores. I didn't really have occasion to shop much, but I went into tons and tons of Walmart stores when I was doing my research because that was important for me to do, to see what they were doing, to talk to workers, to get an idea of exactly what was going on.
Any secrets you can share with us about the layout of stores and the philosophy behind that?
Well, Walmart is actually very ingenious in the way that they approach this. They, in some stores, they actually study where you go in the store and don't buy things. They track that so that they can look at what objects they should have next to what other objects. So that, you know, say, for example, I mean, this is kind of obvious that you would have, say, the toothpaste next to the dental floss. But there are other things that are not quite so obvious. I mean, maybe if you're going to go buy videos, you want to have the corn chips next to the videos, you know, so that people who are going to, you know, buy one might have the other if they're going to go home and watch a video and snack. I mean, that's one example. But they study what they call adjacencies, what to have next to what, very, very carefully. And so they're always looking at where people go in the stores, including where they go and don't buy things, so they can figure out if they need to move stuff around to make it easier for shoppers to pick up whatever they need.
What are the dead spots in the stores?
The dead spots?
Yeah, where people don't buy things.
Well, I think it varies. Try the bottom part of the aisle, the bottom part of each shelf. I mean, the stuff that is at eye level is the stuff that moves faster than the stuff that's two shelves down, right. For example.
Bob Ortega, you have this new book about Walmart. You covered retailing for several years for the Wall Street Journal. Did all of this reporting on retailing change your perceptions as a consumer, as a shopper?
Oh, yeah, I would say absolutely. Now, you know, I won't say that I never buy anything that's made overseas because that isn't true, but I'm certainly much more conscious about what I buy. When I go into a store, I look at labels. I'd like to know where something is made. In some cases, it's because I've been to, say, Guatemala, and I know what the factory conditions are like there, and it concerns me. And in some cases, I just like to, you know, get a good feel for it. There are some which is not to say that everything made overseas is bad. Take Bangladesh, for example. Because of some of the actions that certain companies, Levi Strauss is one example, that certain companies have taken to improve the conditions in their factories, and because UNICEF and other groups have become active, Bangladesh, not that long ago, signed an agreement to improve the conditions in all of its factories and to try to reduce and eliminate the use of child labor. That hasn't happened entirely yet, but the country is moving very quickly in that direction, I think. And if this really comes through, then I would have no problem personally buying something made in Bangladesh, because I think that you could feel that at least those workers are working under reasonably good conditions. But at the same time, if the workers are making so little that they can't even meet the cost of living, then I think that's a matter of concern. For example, when I was in Guatemala, there were workers. One of the reasons that you have a lot of child workers there is that the wages are so low that the parents by themselves can't support the family. So they send the kids out to work. And instead of being in school, you have 11 and 12-year-old girls that are working as much as 90 hours a week in some of these factories making clothing.
I think that there are some people who would like to make sure that the items that they're buying were not manufactured by people who are getting exploited in sweatshops. But, you know, it's hard to even look at a label and really know what the story is. Even if it says it's made in a country, you don't know what the conditions in that particular factory are. And most of us don't know what the conditions are in each country. And, I mean, you know, how much research is each of us willing to do before we go out and buy toothpaste or a shirt?
Well, I don't think you have to. I mean, the reality is that although a lot of people will argue that, well, gee, this is just the way business is done, and, you know, most people don't care, all they want is the low price, in fact, that's not the case. Just a couple of weeks ago, a number of very large American companies, including Nike, Reebok, Liz Claiborne, Eddie Bauer, several others, all signed this sweatshop agreement to allow independent monitors into their factories to check on conditions. Now, they're not doing this out of the goodness of their heart. They're doing this because they're very concerned that Americans, that at least enough Americans, care about these issues, that they need to address them. Walmart, by the way, was unfortunately not a signatory to that agreement. But I think that this is a situation where really it's not so much that you have to fret every time you go into a store about, oh my God, is this, you know, how do I know? Or, gee, this is overwhelming, I better not think about it, as much as if you really care about this issue, if you were to sit down and, say, write a letter, you know, to Walmart and say, hey, I'm concerned about this, or to, you know, whoever it might be, then you're going to see a response, because that's the way that capitalism works, because companies know that you're free to spend your money anywhere, and they're afraid that if something like this becomes an issue, that you may choose to spend your money at some other outfit. And that's why a lot of these corporations are now moving to respond to these concerns.
Well, Bob Ortega, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Glad to be here.
Bob Ortega is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. His new book about Walmart is called In Sam We Trust. Coming up, awareness in everyday places. This is Fresh Air. I take a walk, I often ignore the things around me that I consider dull and boring, like telephone poles, parking meters, and parking lots. Those are just the kinds of details that John Stilgoe finds fascinating. He thinks that by observing the ordinary things we take for granted in our surroundings, we can learn fascinating details about our environment. Stilgoe is a professor of landscape history at Harvard. He teaches his students how to be mindful of their surroundings and the pleasures that mindfulness can bring. He's written a new book called Outside Lies Magic, Regaining History and Awareness in Everyday Places. Here's how he describes his approach to helping people observe the world around them.
What I try to do is to first help people simply go for a walk, not for the physical reasons, not, you know, to lose weight, improve one's heart rate or something, but to go for the walk simply to look around them. And then later, after they start noticing stuff, to trust themselves to figure out what the patterns are. The pattern can be anything from finally noticing that every utility pole in America has a number nailed on it, fixed to it somehow, and one can locate oneself in space by simply, you know, saying, oh, I'm next to pole number 371 on such a street or something. One notices the patterns, one figures things out for oneself, and it's something one always has. It never devalues. To be an acute observer of the world around one, I think, pays tremendous dividends in all sorts of ways.
I'm glad you mentioned telephone poles, because you have a fascinating chapter just all about them. I think we all grew up just taking them for granted that there's wooden poles with wires strung on them. When did they first come into being, and why wooden poles?
Well, wooden poles came into being much earlier than electric service. They came into being with the invention of the telegraph. And they came, the reason they're wood, they were wood, and they're still wood, is that we're still a developing nation. We have a tremendous expanse of territory to carry wires across, and the utility companies don't have the money to put up steel or concrete poles all across rural America, even in suburbs. My interest in utility poles dates actually to not only my own curiosity about why we don't look up at them, why we don't really see them, although they're almost everywhere, and they're very rarely vertical. They're usually out of plumb by a little bit because of the stresses of the lines they carry. But the deeper issue is that in the 1910 to maybe 1940 period, a great many critical people, very thoughtful people indeed, realized that this was a huge spider web being dropped down over the American public, that it trapped one into using something that was surely an advantage by almost everybody's standards, but required a monthly payment. So the first real discussion of a web across the United States was in a much earlier period.
You know, you point out that cable TV wires are being strung on old poles that weren't designed for them. And the wire that goes into your home if you live in a neighborhood, they're so sloppily hung often. And I just thought, I'd never thought of that as like a national pattern, but I guess it is.
Well, it's the kind of thing one notices if one goes out for a walk, because mm-hmm. Eventually if one looks up with no knowledge of electrical engineering at all and simply looks up in the air for a few minutes, one begins to figure out, you know, which are the electric company wires, which are the phone company wires, and which are the cable TV wires. And the cable TV wires are the ones lowest on the pole, almost invariably. The cable invention came much later. And now what I'm noticing is that with the tremendous demand for internet service, the phone companies are having to restring cables to bring more lines down streets. And all of this goes on slightly up above the level at which most Americans look. And if one does look up there, one not only sees the wires, one sees the crowns of trees, one sees the birds flying among the wires, and the way on a winter morning, lines of birds will sit on electric lines to warm their feet.
Is that why they do it?
Yes. There's a certain amount of resistance to transmitting the electricity, and the resistance, I don't know how to put it exactly, manifests itself as heat. And the birds sit on the electric lines, warm their feet, their legs, I suppose their stomachs, but they'll just all line up. And they seem to sit on different lines. They seem to sit on lines, how should I put it, that they know about. When I go to work, I've noticed that there's one particular line that always has birds on it on a winter morning, and the lines all around it in the neighborhood never do.
My guest is John Stilgoe. He's a Harvard professor and author of the new book, Outside Lies Magic, Regaining History and Awareness in Everyday Places. Now, I know one of the things that you recommend that we all try to do is to follow the tracks of abandoned railroads, commuter lines. What's interesting about that?
Well, many of these lines have been made into pedestrian paths or bike paths, and I think they don't get nearly the use they should. But the significance for me is that if one walks down them with an open mind, not for physical exercise alone, but for a little bit of mental gymnastics, one begins to realize that these lines often are much more direct than the highways that replace them. And now what I find in many places in the United States, if I walk, is that on these abandoned lines, is that there are the first very faint signs that they might be reactivated. And I began, the only reason I stumbled into this is I walked along railroad lines, and I began to notice every now and then, maybe on the side of the line, there'd be an orange-painted surveyor stake. And I started to realize that, you know, deep money real estate investors have begun to realize that, you know, there was a station here once before. It's long gone. But if this railroad track comes back, this is going to be a very valuable piece of property. They buy it. They pay taxes on the woods, the half-abandoned vacant lot, and they wait. And now sometimes I've, you know, seen the first evidence of the surveyor's sign, the stakes and so on, being put out by people who have been hired by the various, you know, state and local governments to see about bringing the trains back. This is only an example of what I try to explain to my readers, that if they would go out and look around, they'd often see the signs of things that are coming that haven't been reported in the newspaper, they haven't been reported by other news media at all. But the first little glimmerings are there in the landscape of change.
I wonder if you've spent a lot of time observing the areas around airports. I think a typical experience that certainly people in Northeast cities have is that you come back from a vacation in a beautiful place, you land at the airport in your Northeast city, and you drive away from the airport, and you're surrounded by gas tanks and sewage plants and automobile junkyards, and suddenly you're in this kind of like industrial ugliness.
I have studied this. And the reason for that is, first, the noise of the airplanes, which causes the real estate to be poorly valued. And secondly, the early 20th century belief that you didn't want to locate a business near an airport because the flying machine was bound to land on it and, you know, destroy it. So what we have now are areas of the typical American city that in which most of the urban residents don't go to, and they go through only, as you correctly point out, to get to the airport. The airplane traveler has a real jolt. I mean, as you point out, it's bad enough to come into the airport and see the industrial zone around it. It's much worse when one has been on vacation in a beautiful place. And I do encourage people to walk or bicycle through these great industrial areas, first because they are the public property. It is often where the sewage disposal area is and so on. But if you don't know about them, you don't know about the opportunities that exist in them. If one goes and looks at these places, one finds that very frequently there are struggling retail businesses in the middle of them where one can get a very good deal on anything from automobile tires to furniture imported from South America. But we tend not to think about ever going to one of these neighborhoods for pleasure.
I have one last question for you. You are so keen in your observations about your environments. You've been in the studio of WBUR recording this interview. Did you notice anything that piques your curiosity?
Radio station engineers have frightful posture. I think it's because they're slouched over these controls all the time, and they're in chairs that are not very well-made chairs. I mean, if I were going to sit all day, I'd get a chair as comfortable as they provide the guest, but they don't provide a chair as comfortable for the engineer who's in it. And that's where I'd make my first improvement here. I'd get these guys better chairs, and then they wouldn't be, I think, slouching. I see a thumb being raised behind the glass.
Our engineer is smiling, too. Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
John Stilgo is the author of the book Outside Lies Magic. He's a professor of landscape history at Harvard. Coming up, a new CD by a Swedish pianist who influenced the ECM sound. This is Fresh Air. The Swedish pianist Bobo Stenson was born in 1944 and came up playing jazz around Scandinavia, where he developed enough of a reputation to get hired by Stan Getz for an African tour in 1968 and to work regularly with American bassist Red Mitchell. From the 70s on, Stenson has worked with several bands mixing jazz and various world musics, often collaborating with musicians from Turkey and India. Stenson has also recorded for the ECM record label off and on for 27 years. Jazz critic Evan Whitehead says Stenson's style and ECM's corporate taste are a perfect fit.
Pianist Bobo Stenson on ECM Records, playing in what you might call typical ECM mode. Almost 30 years ago, ECM began documenting an airy style of improvised music, full of pregnant silences, mood enhanced by lots of cavernous echo. The ECM sound gets a bad rap for helping inspire new age music, but the original usually had more bite. Bobo Stenson's new album, War Orphans, includes two tunes by Ornette Coleman, whose raucous free jazz may seem an unlikely source for this music, but in a way, it's the wellspring. It was hard for piano players to find a role in Coleman's quickly shifting music. The first one who figured out how to do it was Paul Blay, who treated the piano like another horn, playing long lines more than background chords, and lagged a little behind the beat, as if waiting to hear where everyone else was headed before committing himself. That approach worked so well, Blay stuck to it in any context. You can hear that line of development in Bobo Stenson's version of the tune Sediment, written by his bass player, Anders Jorman. Thirty years ago, Scandinavian jazz musicians started developing what became their contribution to the ECM style, music which was restrained and song-like and a little tentative. Bobo Stenson is so typical of the Scandinavian ECM school, he stands as a representative figure. You can hear parallels between his playing and that of ECM's breakout star Keith Jarrett, who was also inspired by Ornette Coleman and Paul Blay, and began recording for ECM in 1971. Soon after that, Jarrett had a quartet with three Scandinavians who'd already been playing with Stenson, including Norway's tasteful drummer John Christensen. He also plays on Stenson's new CD. It was a critic's cliché to compare ECM music to icy echoes resounding across a fjord. Fjords are actually too wide to echo, but few of us critics had ever seen one. Stenson's wholesome improvised melodies can resemble Swedish folk music more than the blues. That's why this stuff doesn't even sound like jazz to some people. Bill Evans's introspective piano jazz is somewhere behind it, but Stenson's work with musicians from India also left a mark. There are odd similarities between his jazz and Indian traditional music. An emphasis on a meandering line, improvised from some basic motifs, music which may start slow and out of tempo and gradually build in intensity. Duke Ellington's Melancholia, played by Bobo Stenson's trio. Like a lot of quote-unquote typical ECM music, the CD War Orphans seesaws between the touchingly lyrical and the slightly precious. Whether jazz fans like it or hate it or don't care, ECM style long since established itself as an important wing of modern jazz. Even other labels imitate it. But as with other well-defined styles, its development has often been haphazard. A matter of individual musicians, like Bobo Stenson, groping along and picking up ideas here and there, just putting together what works for them.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of New Dutch Swing. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Ferriby is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Levenger, Tools for Serious Readers. Catalog information available, 800-544-0880. And Columbia Legacy, whose Bob Dylan Live 1966 The Royal Albert Hall Concert documents Dylan's transformation from acoustic folk to electric rock music. Available at record stores nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.